It's to the best of our knowledge. I'm Anne Strandchamps. What does your job say about you?
In an issue of Harper's Magazine, Arthur Miller, in an article on playwriting, wrote, "I do not believe you could tell about a man without telling about the world in which he lives in, what he does for a living. Not only what he was like at home, but on the job."
In the 1960s, journalist Studs Terkel spent years crisscrossing the country talking with people about their working lives.
Now, so many of us would not like to need the jobs we have, but we must get down to fundamentals. Certainly, it's a necessity that has for so many decades sent so many men deep down into the bowels of the earth, into the collieries of Wales, the Borinages of Belgium, the soft coal pits of Pennsylvania, the anthracite mines of West Virginia. And always in songs, there's the old miner who wants others never to send their kids into the mines.
Now some people say a man's made out of mud, but a poor man's made out of muscle and blood. Muscle and blood, skin and bones, a mind that's weak and a back that's strong. You load 16 tons, and what do you get? Another day older and deeper in debt. St. Peter, don't you call me, 'cause I can't go. I owe my soul to the company store.
So, that was then. This hour, in the spirit of Studs Terkel, let's talk about work today. How it's different, and also how it's the same. Now, maybe you don't feel like you owe your soul to the company store anymore. Maybe you feel more like it's on loan, temporarily, like your job. On paper, the labor market looks great today. The unemployment rate is at a historic low. Economists say anyone who wants a job has one or can get one. So then why do so many American families feel like this?
My husband and I had savings. We had established careers. We had our daughter 7.5 years ago when we were middle-aged already. But at that same time, we were buying our health insurance. We were freelancers. Journalism itself was in free fall. That was our industry, and it lost 50% of jobs since 2006. We just were going through our savings, and we were really concerned for the future.
Alyssa Quart spent the last few years, like Studs Terkel before her, traveling around the country, talking with all kinds of people about work. And what she found is a lot of us have jobs that look good on paper, but we feel squeezed.
I think I was probably most moved personally by the academics because I had been an adjunct professor and my parents had been community college professors and then regular professors. So when I was speaking to a number of different professors who were living close or below the poverty line, they were on food stamps. One adjunct who was homeless, who was living in her car, I talked to her. And more have come out to me. People who were journalists who were living in tents, all these out-of-work adjuncts who were also on food stamps and public assistance. I felt like I needed to tell their stories, and I was really wrenched by this feeling that people could no longer do what they love and that they were blaming themselves when all their hard work wasn't coming to fruition.
What got to me most were the stories about families. I mean, you talk about visiting a 24-hour daycare center.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a very powerful experience, just to be with those kids, feeling the love of these daycare operators who were also stretched really thin themselves. And then I looked at the numbers of that, and it was 9% of daycares are now at off hours, you know, at nights, wow, Weekends, weird times in the morning.
You just wouldn't think there'd be that much need for 24-hour daycare.
The truth of it is that people are working very unusual hours now and multiple jobs. And we call them side hustles to try to make it sound more cute and likable. But side hustles mean that you're probably overworking and also very splintered in your daily activities. You might be working 20 hours one place and 20 hours another, right? That I saw a lot of. I saw people driving Uber nights, weekends, in the afternoon after teaching. They were school teachers, or school teachers who were painting houses after the last school bell because they couldn't afford their rent.
So your primary message for all of us is, anybody feeling squeezed, is it's not your fault. Do people think it is?
Yeah. I mean, I think people know on some level that there's all these systemic pressures, that middle-class life is 30% more expensive than it was 20 years ago. College tuition fees have jumped 35% from 2006 to 2016. People know this intellectually, but you can't help but think, why am I personally not making this work? Have I done something wrong? Am I immature? Have I not worked hard enough? And I think there's an ethos of 1% worship in this country, too, worshiping the wealthiest, watching television shows about them, that kind of fools us into thinking that's the life that we should be living or that our neighbors are living, when really they may be struggling just as much as we are. But that kind of adds to the self-blame, right? Because you're mm-hmm. watching these shows and you're looking at your social media feeds where someone found that statistically people post pictures of themselves in more expensive locales than they actually live. It's not an illusion. People are trying to look richer than they are online.
Yeah. And the level of self-blame and self-hatred, especially for this group we're talking about, I'm sure there are voices in their heads that are like, if you're smart enough to get a PhD, why aren't you smart enough to get a job?
Right, exactly. And some of the response to some of these character stories, the uncharitable responses often from people with very different attitudes about self-reliance, readers, they would write in, why are these people single? Some of them were single mothers. Not everyone in the book is a single mother, but there are a number. Why did they make sure they had a steady marriage before doing this? Or why did they get a degree in history and not in computer science? To me, it seems like there's a lot of blaming of others going on as well as self-blame.
What was it like doing that reporting? I mean, you must have had to get to a point with them where they trusted you enough and felt comfortable enough to talk about things that they probably were hiding in some cases from friends and family members.
To me, that is my passion, really, as a writer, is to get to know people and to, I kind of sometimes feel like I disappear into their stories when I'm reporting. So maybe there was something about that that opened people up, made people feel a little reassured that I actually really wanted to hear. Like I wasn't just trying to get it for a book. I wanted to know. I wanted to feel what they felt.
What do you tell people about how to stop blaming themselves?
I kept saying, and I started saying it to the subjects when I was interviewing them, this is a system failure, because I talked to a journalist who was just so angry at herself. She couldn't afford the soccer fees for her daughter, and they had to take in a roommate, and she was racking up debt. This is like so many subjects of this book. She said, I'm doing something wrong. She had been a reporter at a newspaper for 20 years. I said, no, you're not. This is a system failure. There should be support for you, and there should be some continuance of your professional life that makes sense. And those conversations, we can sort of have them with one another. But I think first we have to get over the shame and stigma that might prevent us from being open about the struggles that we're having.
How did she react when you said, no, it's a system failure, it's not you?
The thing is, most of the people I was talking to would take it in and go, oh, yeah, yeah. But I didn't know whether they were really absorbing it. Some of them were politically motivated people who were activists, but I felt like even they would toggle back and forth between the sense of stigma and the sense of outrage.
And also, I think because the causes are so huge, it's hard to grasp. I'm not an economist.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a feeling, too, that a lot of our economy is mystified, right?
Yeah.
Why is this happening to us? Why are wages not reflecting the fact that we have near full employment or that there's a record corporate wealth? What is the mechanism that's preventing this from happening?
Yeah, it feels like we got sold a bill of goods somehow. There were decades there where people kept saying, your career would be better if you just followed your passion and doesn't pay the bills.
We were sold a sort of post-60s idea of self-actualization, which was in response to a stable middle class, right, that was humdrum, that was like a prison that people wanted to escape. Now we'd want that banality back. We'd want to be on the train commuting half an hour rather than an hour and a half.
We wish we could be lifers.
Yeah, we wish we could be in Mad Men, in a sense. Like, some of those shows are actually fantasy spaces and not in the way people think. They're not just people acting badly. They're also a day that runs from 9 to 5 and is very cordoned off in a way.
You know, I think older people, I'm in my 50s, I think we're inclined to feel like we must have screwed up somewhere. How can I be more in debt now than I was in my 30s or 40s? Clearly, I didn't save enough. I didn't do the right things. But for younger people in their 20s and 30s, I think there must be a real sense of betrayal.
I'd like that to be the sense that they have. I would like people to vote along those lines. I'd like people to start organizing along those lines and say, oh, I'm 32. I can't afford to have a kid at all, which some of the millennials I spoke to expressed to me. I can't own property. You know, I'm not going to have a pension. I'm living with all this debt, $1.5 trillion in student debt now. And I'm mad, and I'm going to start aligning my interests with other people who are also precarious rather than with the wealthiest of this country.
So let's talk about solutions, because times are bad and there's a lot of pain. But you did find a lot of people, often even just on a community, neighborhood level, trying to band together, trying to invent new solutions, for example.
Among the bigger solutions, there were things like universal pre-K, subsidized daycare for people on the lower end of the middle class, not just people who are truly deemed needy, universal basic income, which would be a monthly stipend, especially for, say, somebody with a disabled kid or somebody struggling without having a maternity leave. Mm-hmm. That $1,000 a month or $2,000 a month would actually be a huge difference for many of the people I met. There are things we can do for ourselves. We can create situations like co-parenting communities. I wrote about a few people who were not together romantically or biologically related, but they'd live in the same house and they'd serve meals and they'd do childcare for one another. Mm-hmm. So these are the kind of more bespoke things, and they can emerge when we stop blaming ourselves.
You're really talking about a stigma, and we've overcome others, and some we're still working on, like the stigma around mental health. How could we begin to approach erasing the stigma around financial struggle, economic struggle?
Well, I think the main way to lift that stigma is to normalize or naturalize these kind of conversations. In the Victorian era, people repressed sex, and then people repressed death, and now they repress money. So that's sort of, now I feel like people are repressing that. And there's no natural reason why we don't talk about money. People talked about money a lot more in previous eras, right? Or talked about class as a category. Hmm. So I feel like that could be shifted. It would just be people committed to coming out in a way as struggling. I do think of it as a coming out as normal in a way. And saying, this is what normal people are like. 80% of the population or 85% of the population is living like this.
So on a scale between hopeless and hopeful, pessimistic and optimistic, where are you?
I am very optimistic about people because I think what people can do for themselves and one another is amazing. And it's sort of my, people are my chalice or whatever, my religion. Seriously, other people. But I am pessimistic about what our country is doing for its citizens and what it will continue to do. And that's the battle.
Well, thank you for your work. It's great. You made me feel much better that the bathroom ceiling is like completely falling apart and I don't have enough to call repair.
And you should
right
post
now.
It. Famous NPR host lives in
a
dilapidated home.
Dilapidated house, definitely. All the other NPR hosts will be like, yep, me too. Anyway, thank you so much for talking.
Oh, yeah, it's great talking to you, too.
That's Alyssa Quart. Her book is called Squeezed, Why Our Families Can't Afford America. And the late Studs Terkel is our co-host this hour, helping us compare work today with work a generation ago.
You were saying the difference of firemen and other jobs you did.
In a bank, I worked in a post office for 2 or 3 years, and it's like, you're doing work, but you're not getting anything out of it for yourself. You know, like the post office, the mail gets out if you're calling sick or not, but I don't know, a fireman, I feel like I'm doing something, you know, I'm helping. My life is something. I can look back and say, well, I helped put out a fire, or I helped save somebody. Show something that you're on this earth, the earth for. In a bank, it's just paper.
That's the job, fireman's job. Gives your life a meaning. Gives your life something you can point to.
Yeah, I don't know what I'd do if I lost this job.
Well, I'd work in the bank because it's paper.
Yeah, 9 to 5, and it's shit. You know, you're looking at numbers, and it's nothing. Anybody can do it, but I think, I feel I'm special. I think I'm special to be a fireman.
Coming up, does your job give you a sense of meaning? And if not, why not? Doesn't everyone deserve that? I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. There's a trade-off that a lot of us made a long time ago, back at the beginning of our working lives. Money or meaning? If you're really lucky, maybe you have both. But there are an awful lot of people earning decent salaries these days, doing jobs they themselves consider pointless. The anthropologist David Graeber calls them BS jobs, and he says they're epidemic, especially in that circle of hell known as middle management. Graeber's one of the founders of the Occupy Wall Street movement, so he's not a huge fan of the corporate class to begin with. He told Steve Paulson the rise of BS jobs proves there is something really wrong with the 40-hour work week.
Often when I meet people, faculty, spouses, and people like that, and you sort of talk about what you do, I talk about what I do, say, what do you do? And they say, oh, well, nothing really. You think they're being modest, right? So you press them, maybe give them a couple of drinks, and eventually they admit that actually, no, they meant it literally. They literally do nothing all day. Maybe they do work for an hour, and otherwise they sit around making cat memes or updating their Facebook profiles.
But they're actually getting paid doing that.
And they're getting paid really good money. That's the thing. They get paid much more than most people who are actually doing something. And this is what began to fascinate me. You know, there's all these people have these jobs where they seem to get paid to do nothing at all or nothing that they think has any point.
This is not just an occasional thing that happens. It happens a lot?
It happened a lot when I talked to people about their corporate jobs. The fancier the title and the more opaque the title, the more they are likely to admit to you that really they aren't doing anything at all. So I wrote a little essay. I wrote this little piece saying, maybe this is the reason why we don't have a 15-hour week. 100 years ago, they thought we would by now. We actually have eliminated all the jobs that existed back then, and we've just made up these dummy jobs to keep us working, because our society has this idea that everybody has to be working all the time, and people running the system like keeping us off the street. It scares them if people have too much leisure time. And the piece went crazy. Within 2 weeks, it had traveled all over the world. It was coming out in Korean, Estonian. There's a version in Chinese. Then newspapers started running it. I started looking at the comment section, and they were just amazing. Like, finally, someone said it.
So people themselves were admitting this. It's not just that,
yes,
oh, that job over there does nothing for society. They were saying that actually my job,
that's exactly right,
is useless.
If you say my job is completely pointless, were it to disappear, it would either make no difference whatsoever, or the world might be a slightly better place. So if somebody says that, well, I mean, who would know better than you?
And then there was some outfit in the UK that did a survey,
yeah,
on this.
Eventually, there was a survey by YouGov, which is kind of the equivalent of Reuters or something like that. And they discovered that 37% were sure that their job made no significant contribution to the world at all.
Wait, 37% said
37%.
They themselves had BS jobs.
That's right.
Absolutely pointless jobs.
Over a third.
That's astonishing.
Yes.
There were testimonials as well. What kinds of things did people say?
Well, What I did was I went out on Twitter and I sort of solicited testimonies. Have you ever had a job that was just completely pointless, that, you know, had no reason to exist? Tell me all about it. People would send me hundreds of things.
And what kinds of jobs were they?
There were a variety of types. Overwhelmingly, they were not in retail or services or anything like that. They were almost all office jobs. They were basically clerical, administrative, managerial, supervisory sort of jobs.
Middle management jobs.
Yeah, yeah.
So the people who are kind of overseeing employees who actually do the work.
I came up with a little typology based on these testimonies. One of the very common one I got was like, my job is to supervise people who don't need supervision.
So this is different than what a lot of people would consider to be undesirable jobs.
Yes.
Dishwasher in a restaurant, janitor, sanitation worker, street cleaner,
dirty
bus
jobs.
Driver.
Yeah.
We need those jobs.
Absolutely. And that's the interesting thing. I mean, the jobs that are unpleasant, where they don't treat you with dignity and respect, where they don't pay you or give you reasonable benefits, are most likely to be jobs that are actually necessary. Whereas the jobs which reward you the most, your family thinks you're the big success, you walk off in a suit every morning, you get a really high level of pay, a large percentage of these people actually secretly believe their jobs are completely pointless.
So you must have heard some particular stories.
Oh, yeah.
That sort of stayed with you. Tell me about one or two of these.
One of the ones that really stuck in my head is a guy, I gave him the name Eric, I don't even know his real name, who had just got out of college. He was the first guy in his family to go to college, came out with a degree in literature. He got hired to be a computer interface manager for this design company. And he was like, why are they taking me for this job? I mean, I know nothing about computers. And he realized that one guy in the company really wanted to have this thing. Nobody else wanted it. So they intentionally got one that didn't work. So once he figured this out, he tried to see if he could quit. And basically, every time he would try to quit, they would just give him more money. Nothing he could do would get himself fired.
Why? I mean, that doesn't make any sense. Why wouldn't they fire him?
Because they didn't want somebody who was competent, because then maybe there'd be an actual computer interface and people would, I don't know if they were downloading porn or what they were up to. Nobody wanted it.
There's another case that actually, I think, ended up in a newspaper in Spain.
Mm. Yeah, that was a great one.
Some Spanish worker was on the payroll for 6 years. Never went into the office during 6 years, actually turned into a homemade Spinoza scholar, the famous philosopher, and somehow kept getting a paycheck even though he never went to work.
Yeah. In fact, the mayor of the city was going to give him a special medal for long service, but they couldn't find him. And it became something of a scandal, but he had a pretty good excuse. He said, well, my boss didn't like me, so he wouldn't assign me any work. So I was just supposed to sit there on the desk pretending to work all day. And I became incredibly depressed. And this is actually a very common pattern. People with these BS jobs, it has terrible psychological effects. He said, I got a shrink. And I said, what should I do? And the shrink said, well, what do you think would give purpose to your life? And he said, well, you know, I've always been interested in the 17th century Jewish philosopher Spinoza. I said, well, why don't you study him? So he managed to convince the board he was working for the city he was working for the board. And he said he came in if there was an emergency and just went off and became a Spinoza scholar.
I have to say, that seems like a pretty good use of his time.
Yeah, I think the world's better off for it. You know?
Right. Okay, so this is the kind of criticism that we sometimes hear about government jobs, the bureaucracy. There's a lot of fat, there's make work kind of stuff. Supposedly, it's not what happens in the capitalist system in the private sector, but you're saying it goes on there too.
In fact, it goes on even more because since people expect the government's going to be like that, the government's under a lot more pressure to trim down. But corporations, no one's really doing that. You know, they'll speed up the blue-collar workers, creating greater and greater productivity and efficiency and often making their lives a living hell. But it's completely different with white-collar workers. In fact, within these corporations, often there's this process of empire building whereby executives and managers, their prestige, often their salaries, are based on how many people they have working under them.
I find this hard to believe. Don't businesses have every incentive to cut costs? I mean, I get it that, you know, to puff up your own importance in the company, you know, you want to have people under you. But in the grand scheme of things, this really does not make sense.
Well, it doesn't make sense if capitalism works the way we imagine it. But that's the way it worked, you know, in the late 19th century or maybe 1950s, it was still working like that. If you have a bunch of medium-sized firms all competing with each other to manufacture or market things. But nowadays, most capitalist firms, I don't even know if you should call them capitalist, what they're doing is manipulating debt, operating on finance. The profits from Wall Street now come overwhelmingly from either financial companies or the financial divisions of companies like General Electric, General Motors, not the ones who are actually making things. So the actual economic logic is different. It's a lot more like feudalism. So if you're just extracting money and then redistributing it, which is what most corporations are doing nowadays, well, it's a totally different system than if you're trying to actually make stuff and sell them.
So part of the problem is what the economy has become.
Yes.
There aren't enough jobs really to go around anymore because so much is being automated.
Well, if we insist on working 8 hours a day, but why do we need to do that?
Wait, so you're saying that there's no reason to have a society where we work 8 hours a day?
I mean, the average medieval serf probably worked on average about 4 or 5 hours a day. It's historically unprecedented that people should be spending so much of their time working.
I thought the medieval serf was slaving away, you know, at the behest of his master.
No. I mean, you know, our nutrition and health is better than they were, but in terms of leisure, they had a lot more.
So you've laid out what you see as the problem here. I guess the question is, what's the solution? Is there a way to actually restructure society so that it would make us happier?
Yeah. I mean, if you think about it, we've got a real problem the way society is structured. I always point this out when we think about all this rhetoric about the robots taking our jobs. Oh, no, what are we going to do? You know, they're going to automate all the work away. And it which shows just how irrational our economic system is, right? Because I thought capitalism and market systems were supposed to be efficient, right? Well, the prospect of like robots replacing stupid jobs, which we don't want to do, is a problem. Why can't we just redistribute the jobs in a reasonable way so that everybody does a little and then we enjoy ourselves? No, that's completely inconceivable. Apparently.
Well, I mean, the question is, how do people make enough money to live on?
Well, exactly, because we have a stupid system where you don't get any money unless you work. So we could change that. We could just give people the money. There are many different solutions. You could try to shorten working hours, but I like that one.
That way, which is called a basic income, right?
Universal basic income. Why don't we say, look, what has created these robots? Made for the possibility that we have all this wonderful technology, this wonderful education, the stuff that makes our wealth possible. It's not something made up by certain individuals and not others. It's made up collective. It's like language. It's like everybody contributes to this kind of civilization, culture, and knowledge. So why don't we just pay everybody for that, you know?
So, I mean, you're basically saying quit trying to organize society based on an economic system. It's something else.
Yes. Well, you know, even the very idea of an economy only existed for the last few hundred years. If you go back to Shakespeare's time, people didn't say what's going on in the economy. That concept totally didn't exist. You know, a lot of these ideas that we have, that there's a separate sphere where people exchange stuff, and that's like has its own laws. It's a relatively new idea. Most people in history would never have imagined that, just like they never would have imagined that you could sell people your time. The idea of wage labor is bizarre and exotic from the perspective of most people who ever lived.
Take this job and shove it. I ain't working here no more.
David Graeber. He's an anthropologist at the London School of Economics, and he was talking with Steve Paulson about his book, BS Jobs.
You better not try. This job and shove it.
So we're talking about reforming work, fixing work, creating new kinds of work. But you know, maybe we're just not going far enough.
Hi, my name is James Livingston. I teach history at Rutgers University. I'm the author of 6 books by last count. The last one started out with the F word. That's a word I can't say on the radio. It is now titled No More Work. I think it's a dangerous idea.
I dedicate this song to the working man.
The labor market has broken down to the point that it doesn't work for any of us. Labor markets, at least in the modern world, were supposed to produce character. Going to work taught you how to be a good person, how to be punctual, how to do what you were supposed to do. The labor market was also designed to allocate incomes transparently, fairly, clearly. on both counts, the labor market has broken down. So let's say, enough already with the work ethic. Let's get over it. Let us try to recover from the psychological deformation, which I call, this is not exactly new, the Protestant work ethic. Let's try to get over it. It is, in fact, a brand new thing. It's only, let's say, 400 years old. Once upon a time, it used to be, people thought of work as a pain in the ass. This is what you do for a living because you have to do it for a living, and it enslaves you. It doesn't make you free, doesn't create your personality, doesn't build character. It does something else altogether, and then it crushes your soul. The men working on the chain. Yeah. Now, we already know how to get beyond this idea that either you work or you get nothing. We already know how to detach income from work. We know from the welfare system. We know it from transfer payments. We know it by looking at Wall Street. These a**s have earned what they make in millions of dollars in their bonuses. We know how to detach income from work. And so we've already reached a point in our development where something for nothing is available to all of us. The constraint is not financial. The constraint is ideological. The constraint is, we don't know how to think this through. We're still stuck in this place where we think getting something for nothing is bad for us. Where do we go from here? Is there some way for us to actually narrate a future that we want? Once you're able to prove that work is not something that we all have to do, that's when all the utopian possibilities can be glimpsed. That's when we can actually say, oh, what does it mean to be a human being? What is human nature after all?
James Livingston. If you like his ideas, look for his book, No More Work. I'm Anne Strangeamps, and yeah, we're going to take a quick dance break after I say this. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRX. On this Labor Day weekend, I keep going back, in my own mind, to some of the most moving conversations I've ever heard about work, recorded by the late journalist Studs Terkel. Like this one, with labor leader Cesar Chavez.
I went to something like 37 schools and was able to complete through the 7th grade and the beginning of the 8th grade. You know, there's schools we went to and they wouldn't take us in because we happen to be of a different color, you know. Schools that we went to were segregated three ways. Mexicans on one school, Negroes on the other one, and the Anglos on the other one. Days that we couldn't go to school because we didn't have shoes, or days we couldn't go to school because we just didn't have anything to eat.
You know, I'm thinking as we hear Cesar Chavez talk, we speak of two aspects of our country, one we know about and we don't know about at all. The deprivations of the people, in this case, the Mexican-Americans of the Southwest. And Woody Guthrie, as you know, Woody does Dust Bowl ballads, and one of the songs is Pastures of Plenty.
Green pastures of plenty from dry deserts around.
On the edge of your city, you'll see us, and then we come with the dust and we go with the wind.
On the edge of your city,
see me and then I come with the dust and I'm gone with the wind.
You weren't even getting minimum wages for a while, isn't it?
Well, it's a very sad thing that those who harvest the food don't have food themselves. We've been in the struggle now for 5 years. It'll be 5 years next month. So we have people working now at $2 an hour and with some very important gains. The most important thing is that at long last, there's that dignity that's been returned to us. They've seen some victories. They have courage, and it's a movement.
California, Arizona, I've worked on your program.
A man's sense of personal worth. I mean, for all these years, I suppose, with migrant farm workers, Mexicans, minority groups, you feel you're nobody. You're told you're nobody.
Then northward up to Oregon, gather your hearts.
Suddenly the recognition that there's something you can do. You are somebody.
Imagine a group of workers who are working with the same employer for, say, 12 years.
The beets from your ground, I've cut the grapes from the vine.
The strike is won, and then they go in and they sit on a table right across from him, and for the very first time, meet as man to man.
To set on your table your light sparkling wine.
It's a great feeling.
It affects every aspect of life.
Every area.
A sense of personal worth.
Studs Terkel, talking with labor leader Cesar Chavez, who founded what is now known as the United Farm Workers of America. So the labor movement and labor unions have had a tough time in recent years. But there are still new ideas, new ways of thinking about how to create truly democratic workspaces. A couple of years ago, Nikki Okuk started a tire recycling company in Los Angeles. RCO Tires is run along the lines of a worker-owned cooperative. Its employees are people who would ordinarily have a hard time finding any job. Nikki told Shannon Henry Kleiber she got the idea for it when she was working on her business degree at MIT.
Yeah, it's so funny. I think places like MIT, when you take these courses, Dr. Doom comes in and gives you the climate model about how everything's going to go in the next 50 years. Sometimes you can get inspired to think, I could fix this. I could do something. So I said, oh, yeah, I'm just going to go, you know, save the world. I was looking at plastics recycling, bottle recycling, and then finally tire recycling, and decided that was going to be it. And I knew if I was going to build a business, it had to be in my hometown, in my hood.
You're from Compton?
South Central. I mean, Los Angeles.
And so who are your workers and how did they come to RCO?
There was an article in LA Weekly that said that this guy had lost his job because he was a well-known graffiti artist and he'd already served 8 years or something in prison for his art. And I just sort of called out of the blue and I said, you know, if this guy's looking for a job, it's hard, physical, dirty work, but here's what we're doing. You know, we're picking up tires and we're recycling them. So Brian came on board and he's been with us ever since. We are now also now married with a child.
Oh, great.
A lot of the guys came to us out of that type of referral system because people who are formerly incarcerated and have trouble finding employment are very often talking to each other saying, oh, I heard about this place, RCO Tires. They're around the corner. You know, it's hard work, but it's a union job and they hire people who have records.
So tell me, what is a worker-owned cooperative? Give me an example of someone who did something with a worker cooperative that they might not have had the opportunity to do if they're just working for a regular company, a regular CEO.
Well, the dynamics of promotions or taking on more responsibility is interesting. If I were to look at a similar company of a similar size, typically they would have promoted, you know, whoever they thought was their most trustworthy or hardest worker, or very often people are promoted because they can kiss up or there's nepotism involved, or people are brought in from the outside. Inside of RCO, what we did is we just sort of all sat down, a dozen guys in the break room at work, and we talked about it and said, you know, we're going to need somebody to take the lead on the second shift. And honestly, at first, everybody said that they didn't want to do it because they didn't want to be put into a dynamic in which they would be in charge of other people.
Mm-hmm.
And we discussed the options. If we can't choose somebody amongst ourselves, amongst each other, then we'd have to go hire somebody outside. And immediately at that, all 12 guys said, oh, no, we can't do that. We can't do that. We're going to have to figure it out. And they did. They sort of went around the room and asked who was going to step up. And finally, somebody who was very reluctant and didn't want to was nominated and assented and became our next lead.
How's that working out?
Pretty well. He's good at his job.
So as I look around, there's so many stories of workers barely getting by, working several shifts, sometimes working meaningless jobs. There's so many ways in our country that work doesn't seem to be working for people. What are the solutions that you're seeing?
So when I started RCO, I remember that I was so focused on the environmental metrics, right? Every week and month, I would say to myself, oh, we diverted this many thousands of pounds of rubber from landfills. We diverted this many gallons of oil and by manufacturing them into new products. And I'd sort of go to the break room and I'd tell the guys these things because those were the numbers that I was very proud of. And then at another meeting, absolutely none of them cared about any of the environmental metrics.
So interesting. Yeah.
All they kept saying was, one, we're really proud to work at a company that's owned by a Black woman. Sorry, I just got teary.
Oh, they're finding meaning in you.
They take a lot of pride in putting on their uniform, going out in the truck, performing the job well, and then having our customers be impressed by them and thank them for their work. A lot of the guys said that they had not had jobs like that before. You know, what work they had was gig day labor for cash here and there. Very often, I think, two people come out of jail and they end up working for these staffing companies that charge the companies that they're working for, you know, $20, $30 an hour, but then only pay minimum wage. And these guys get bounced around and bounced around and bounced around, and they're treated as incredibly disposable.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things they kept mentioning was they felt indispensable. They felt like they were really needed, and they appreciated that feeling of being a part of something. They just said all sorts of incredible things that I wasn't expecting.
I'm picturing your break room. You've mentioned the break room. What happens there? I'm kind of picturing this group of people together talking about all kinds of things. What's it like?
We eat a lot of tacos.
Yeah, that sounds good.
The other thing I think that happens a lot in the break room, interestingly, now that you ask me, is compassion. Anybody who's ever been poor knows that this is for sure true, right? Like being poor takes a lot of work because crazy things happen. You know, you might be late on a bill and your light bill gets cut off, or, you know, you got a ticket, but you didn't have the money to pay it at the time. So now you got to go down to the courthouse, or car maintenance is let go. And so then your car breaks down and your wife's trying to pick up the kids from school, or just tons of things go wrong all the time, which means that people miss work. So we get to our break room at 7 in the morning every morning, and we sort of look around and we have to ask ourselves, okay, well, who's here? Who are we missing today because of one of these crazy things that just always happens when you don't have enough money to cover all your bases?
It's like triage.
Yeah. And I think that in a lot of other workplaces, everybody would be frustrated. They'd be like, oh, I can't believe this guy missed another day at work. Oh, I can't believe this person is running late because of a car issue again. But the guys are very patient with each other and compassionate with each other and try to be helpful and pick up the slack and fill in where they can when somebody is missing. Very often, God, people, I don't know if some of your listeners will understand exactly what I'm saying, but I don't know if you know what it is to be Black or brown out here in South Central walking around. You get arrested like all the time for nothing. You'll be going onto the train and the cops are like stopping you while you're getting on the train and asking for your ID. My husband was taking the kids out of the car and the cops pulled up and asked him if he had drugs or guns and then tackled him in our driveway and arrested him for resisting arrest. So these things happen all the time. So one of the other reasons why we're constantly missing people at work is because they're being kidnapped by the police.
Wow.
The first thing we do when somebody shows up to work and they haven't called anybody and they haven't notified anybody is to log onto the sheriff's website and see if maybe they got picked up somewhere and when they're going to be released. And very often charges are never brought against them. they just lost a day or two of their lives and probably their job. And then there's a trickle-down effect to that, right? Because if it wasn't us, if it wasn't RCO, if they were working somewhere else and they lost their job, well, what do you lose next? Your housing.
Wow. How can workers have more of a voice than they do now? So many workers get sidelined. So many workers aren't noticed. How can they have more of a voice?
Unionize. I come from a seven-generation union family, and my mother still works for a labor union. However, I have never had a union job. And I think that that's true for a lot of people in my generation who don't have never worked with a union, been a member of a union, may not have even had a parent who was a union member. That was one of the first things that we did at RCO was to unionize because, you know, they understand that only through their numbers, only through the fact that they actually lubricate this entire economy with our sweat, blood, and our tears, that they can sometimes hold the powers that be hostage. I think that the port is a great example of that, too. I work very closely with the port, and people are always saying, we don't like the union at the port. They hold us hostage. And I'm, you know, well, these are working class people that have control of a very important asset of our economy, and they should use it to demand better lives for ourselves.
You have an economics degree from Columbia and a master's in business, right, from MIT. Did you study this or did you think work is not the way it should be in my city and I'm going to take everything I've learned in these institutions and bring it out to real people?
I think everybody says to themselves at one point in their life that work is not the way it should be.
I would agree with that. Yes. Yeah.
It's really difficult to break out of a mindset that we've been raised in and educated in and worked in for our entire lives. It's so difficult to step back and try to imagine a different possibility for yourself, one in which nobody in the room is above you or dictating to you, that you're there of your own volition, that you're not being sort of demanded mm-hmm. and compelled by money in a way that isn't healthy or natural or fulfilling. I mean, everybody is motivated by money in the sense that we need money to support ourselves and support our families and buy the type of lifestyle that we want. But it's a very different dynamic, I think, when the employer doesn't feel it's their right to demean people, to antagonize people, to demand from people.
That makes so much sense. You want to have some autonomy in what you do every day. How can we make this happen more in our society?
Yeah, it's a question I ask myself every day.
That's Nikki O'Cook, who heads RCO Tires in Los Angeles and hopes someday her workers will vote to buy back their company and take control. And that was Shannon Henry Kleiber talking with her. And that's it for our Labor Day show, but we're going to give the last word to the man who has been our touchstone this hour, the late Studs Terkel, along with steelworkers Ed Sadlowski and Joe Gutierrez.
Society does not need, no society does not need, you know, a surplus of machine screw operators. We can have machines make machine screws, and let's put men in the areas of where we can, you know, read poetry and play violin. That's what that Rose question is about. Pass that on to your kid. What the hell do I want to pass on machine screw operator to my kid?
Eddie, what's the word you and Joe say as we've had a just easy conversation about labor today and the view of it publicly and scabs once ashamed, now unashamed, and sense of community we're talking about. Well, union means community, of course. Sure. So as we go into the two songs, a bit of that early one, the Almanac sang, Roll Union On, starring into Bread and Roses too, a thought perhaps.
Great songs for those issues at the time. But you've got to sing your own song.
You've got to write your own song and you've got to sing your own song. It's very difficult to march to someone else's song. And I firmly believe, I really believe, that those songs will be written and those songs will be sang by the very people of this generation, even though they're not hip to it right now. Unfortunately, they will be with the economic situation continuing to develop the way it is.
Oh, yeah. All right.
Share your song with us at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio in Madison, Wisconsin. Shannon Henry Cliver produced this hour. With help from Charles Monroe Kane and Mark Rickers. Thanks to the Chicago History Museum and WFMT for archival audio. Joe Hartke is our sound designer and technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm your host, Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.